Welcome to the Midday. I'm Norman Gilliland, and as part of the centennial celebration of the Pro Arte Quartet, they have commissioned works by major American composers, and the first one will have its world premiere on Saturday night. That's October 22nd, 8 o'clock in Mills Concert Hall at the UW-Madison. And it will feature, among other things, the first performance of the String Quartet No. 2 by Walter Mays, who is in our studio. Welcome.
Glad to be here.
When you get a commission for a work, I would guess that there would be two ways to do it. One would be, well, let's see, I have this string quartet that I've already kind of been thinking about in the back of my mind. Let me see if I can bring that to fruition. Or, on the other hand, you might just start from scratch. How did it work this time when you got that commission?
Well, this time, this is the second commission that I've had for a quartet and from Pro Arte. I did a quartet about, it's been nearly 14 years ago now with them. And so I already knew these particular players. And so that had a particular influence on me that perhaps the first commission didn't have. I know that this is a group, not only a world-famous group of chamber music players, but they have a lot of virtuosity individually. They're soloists, so I wanted to do a work which would show off this virtuosity, which my first quartet was involved with very dark issues, and virtuosity it's a difficult piece, but that virtuosity didn't play a part in that. And in fact, at the time, I had wanted to do a quartet which would be lighter and more playful and would actually show off the virtuosity of the first violinist. David Perry had been the concertmaster in Wichita, where I was teaching, and we were colleagues for about 5 years, 6 years. So I already knew David and had for a long time planned to do something, maybe some kind of concerto or sonata for David. But then when the first commission came up, I thought, well, this is my chance to do a virtuoso work for David. But it just didn't happen. And in the summer of, I believe it was 97, when I was already a little overdue on the commission, I began to get violent explosions in my head with chords and followed by violent explosions, and I punched this up onto the computer and wrote the first few bars of what seemed like to be what I was hearing, and it was very compelling, and I thought, I have to go with this. I don't understand it, but I have to go where this leads. And so I put aside the lighter, more playful piece and wrote a very serious, almost Cold War kind of piece. It was very successful, and they played it a number of times and recorded it. And I have moved on in other ways as my style has changed in 14 years. But I came back to the first quartet, to the first idea for the quartet when they commissioned me. And I have finally produced a work which does not have Freudian angst in it. And it's called, I wanted to mention that it, the subtitle for this work is called Dreaming Butterfly, which is refers to a famous story or dream from the 2nd century B.C. Chinese philosopher, Taoist philosopher by the name of Zhuangzi. And Zhuangzi dreamed one night that he had been transformed into a butterfly and that he had all these wonderful adventures as a butterfly and no cares at all as a human being and was completely unaware that he was a human being. But then he awoke and realized he was still Zhuangzi, but he was left with a puzzle that maybe he was actually a butterfly dreaming that he was a man still. And so this Taoist idea is that all living things are interrelated, or maybe not even all living things, all parts of the universe are interrelated, and that your point of view is relative. Depending on whether you happen to be a butterfly or a man. So I have transformed a butterfly into a string quartet, or maybe I've transformed a string quartet into a butterfly. But it gave me the perfect vehicle to introduce more virtuosity than you would normally put into a piece of chamber music.
The dream state seems to play a large role in your composing.
I guess it has. Because there's the earlier work called Dreamcatcher, based on Native American material, and the form is somewhat simpler. Is similar in Dreamcatcher. There is two outer sections of what I would call sleep music or night music. And then there's a nightmare in the middle, which represents the bad dreams. And that forms the shape. And in the new quartet, I have two sections of dream music at the beginning and at the end. And then there are three very playful adventures in the middle that represent the life of the butterfly. So there is a similarity there. I've thought a little bit about this. When you live in a place like Kansas, there are two choices for an artist. Either you can really get involved with the landscape and the local personalities and the local artist, or you can fantasize about faraway places. And I tend to be one who fantasizes. Uh-huh. I don't blame that on Kansas. It's just the way it happens to be.
Well, you know, kind of like Dorothy.
Yeah.
Well, speaking of dreams and dream catcher, as long as you've set it up so beautifully, Walter, we're going to do something a little unconventional for the midday, and this piece is a little longer than we'd ordinarily hear. It's just under 13 minutes, but in order to get the good dreams and then the bad in the middle, we'll have the whole thing. And the dream catcher refers to this Native American device that many of us have seen.
Right, and it's, by the way, an artifice of woodland Indians. It's not plains Indians, woodland Indians, the Ojibwe, Anishinaabe, I believe they're called. They construct out of sinews and twigs. They construct a circular object. It's a magical object, and only really a person with a medicine man with power can actually invest this with the power it needs. It's placed over the sleeper, and the good dreams know the way, the good spirits know the way through, and the bad spirits get hung up in the webbing and are destroyed with the coming of daylight. So my youngest daughter, who's a graphic designer, went to a powwow, and she came back and she said, "Dad, you really have to do a piece based on this dream catcher." And I put it away because people come up to me oftentimes and tell me, "You need to do this kind of piece and that one." I was at the time writing a piece for wind ensemble. I had two pieces going, a very violent, powerful piece, and then I had a very soft, almost Debussy-like piece going, and I couldn't make up my mind which way to go. And then here, I woke up the next morning, and suddenly it became clear to me that I can combine both pieces. I can put the impressionistic music on the outside for the dream, and I can put the violent music in the middle for the nightmare, and the form of Dreamcatcher was born.
So just hang on as we pass through the violent dream in the middle to get back to the softer, more impressionistic finale. This is Dreamcatcher by my guest today, Walter Mays, and it's played by the North Texas Wind Symphony, Eugene Corporan conducting. Fade out, which is kind of an unusual ending, although you hear it occasionally. And
but when you walk away from a powwow, they're still going on.
Well, that's true. And it's a little bit the same effect that you get in something like in the Steppes of Central Asia, you know, the Borodin piece where
right.
it recedes as the caravan
right.
passes
right.
from view. So very effective, though. That was a piece called Dreamcatcher by my guest today, composer Walter Mays. And when did you write that?
Dreamcatcher was in 95.
So before even that first string quartet that you wrote for the
yes,
Poarty.
Yes.
And so what is a composer's role when you come toward a big debut, the 22nd of October being this world premiere?
Well, my wife tells me that it's a little bit like Odysseus in the Odyssey, that when he goes by the sirens, he's instructed by Circe that his men tie him to the mast.
Right.
And they put wax in their own ears. And when he says, do this, do that, don't pay any attention to what he says. Don't release him. She says that when I listen to my music, I need to be tied to the chair and not allowed to interfere.
There are composers I've heard of who will actually literally, just before the performance, I mean minutes before, they're changing notes.
Yes, I've been known to do that. And there again, you know, you start with a broad concept, or I start with a broad concept in composition, and at the end I get down to many very small details, even involving editing the score and the parts and so forth, and you can just get lost in those details, and at some point you have to step back and say, all right, I've done the best I can, now it's in their hands, and details are important, but the overall picture is much more important. Don't do anything to interfere with the overall picture. So we're at that phase, and the quartet, it's already beautifully prepared. They sent me a video about a week ago of what they had prepared, and it was so close to what I want that I really should not do anything to them.
Isn't that an interesting phenomenon, how, I mean, a composer, and this would be true of a playwright, too, mm-hmm. or a film writer, or any number of artists who, once you finish it, it kind of belongs to the world, doesn't it?
It does, because like a playwright, we don't present our material raw to the world like a painter. We need an interpreter, and only the interpreter can actually bring it to life. So when you have a good interpreter and they have a lot of life and they bring a lot of character, you don't want to interfere with that.
If you had your choice today, what would you be composing? I mean, if you didn't have to worry about commissions and you didn't have to worry about schedules and deadlines, I mean, what's that pet piece back there that you really want to get to?
Well, you know, that's changing for me. I studied with a man who, by the name of Lubunsky, who was a secretary to Prokofiev and who studied orchestration in Paris with Dukas of the Sorcerer's Apprentice. So I'm a second-generation Dukas student, and wow. I write very well for orchestra, and I've done some orchestral pieces. I haven't really quite succeeded in breaking into making that my main activity. And I would say that, but I have enjoyed working with quartet now to the point and learned so much about quartet. And we have also a wonderful quartet where I am in Wichita called the St. Petersburg Quartet, world-class quartet. And they've invited me to do something. I think I'm 70 now, and I hope for another 10 years of writing. And I think I'm going to do quartets because the level of artistry and sophistication you can accomplish in a quartet is, I think, beyond what you can accomplish with an orchestra.
That's such an interesting observation, a little bit surprising.
It surprises me. I wouldn't have said that because I have a big background in orchestral writing. I've been an orchestral player as a clarinetist, so I have a good feel for that. But you can't do the subtleties with an orchestra that you can do with a quartet.
And you can hear the world premiere of the String Quartet No. 2 by Walter Mays on Saturday night. That's October 22nd, this Saturday night, 8 o'clock, Mills Concert Hall. And the work is written as part of the centennial celebration of the UW-Madison's Pro Arte Quartet. And also on the program, music by Bloch and Samuel Barber and Franz Schubert. With Walter Mays, we're going to be going now from Catching Dreams, Dreamcatcher in particular, to moon dances. So this again suggests the otherworldly.
Yes, this is another piece of mine based on Native American music. This is based on Mandan music. The Mandan tribe, of course, was a tribe up in somewhere in North Dakota visited by Lewis and Clark.
Yeah.
And mostly gone, decimated by smallpox in the 19th century. But there is a collection of their music from old singers done by Francis Dinsmore in about 1910 or 1920 in that area. And so this is a collection put out by the Smithsonian, and I've used some of these melodies. What's particularly interesting, I use the melodies and the rhythms in quite free ways, but along with it are oral histories. And these songs originally belong to individuals and have the oral history is recorded, and sometimes the oral history is even more interesting than the music. And so that's been quite inspiring. The first dance, by the way, this was commissioned by a friend of mine who's a recorder virtuoso in Munich, Marcus Sonhausen, and the recorder is, of course, this little instrument without keys that that we have all played some version of as a child, but in Europe it's a quite advanced instrument, and there are virtuosos who not only do Baroque music, but who now commission new music for this instrument. Hmm. And he said, when he heard Dreamcatcher, he said, you know, you should do something like that on Native American music for solo recorder, but it needs to be something I can take around without any accompaniment. And at first I wasn't so sure this was a good idea, because I like all this orchestration and special effects. But I did put together, from some leftover material I had done for Dreamcatcher, I began to study the situation, and I found indeed these stories were very nice, and I wrote them out as program notes. The first one is called Moon Dances, and in the moon is a god who watches the young Native American girl, Mandan girls, down by the river who dance at night. And the moon admires them, and he comes down, and he gives them a song of his own for their dancing. And in the second one, there is a lament by a woman who's lost her husband. He went off to war and doesn't come back. It's quite sad lament. And the third one is quite interesting. It's a kind of, it shows the moralistic and instructional values of stories, where it's called Skunk Dance, and it tells about the skunk wanting to go over to the prairie dog town and get some food. The prairie dog town, by the way, I should say, you have these earthen mounds that the prairie dogs build. They're very similar to the type of earthen mounds that the Mandan actually lived in. And so it's an interesting story. So the skunk goes over and dances, and the prairie dogs are hypnotized, and they're led off far away from their village, and then he eats them. And, of course, this is an important message for young warriors, that one skillful warrior can, through guile, can take down a whole community. It also says, don't trust the outsider, which is probably a good piece of advice in a Stone Age culture, society. Right. They like these stories, these notes, so much that my recorder player said, why don't you actually put this into the performance? And so he recites the notes, actually, before in the first one during the piece, and in the latter two just before the piece. He speaks in a very clear English, but with a slight German accent. And so these are the Moon Dances.
Three pieces there by my guest today, Walter Mays. Moon Dances for solo recorder, and quite the virtuosic recorder player too, Marcus Bartholomew. Always good to have the last minute pronunciation there for what is not immediately apparent. And he was also the one giving you the gloss on each of those three movements, including at the end there, the skunk dance, so you find out about the true meaning of being skunked. Well, congratulations on the debut, getting the piece all ready in time for the Prodé Quartet to perform your String Quartet number 2 Saturday night. A pleasure having you this hour, Walter Mays.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Look forward to your next visit.